So, just before we work the transition, Paul Cotman suggested at the break that we might well think about the opening scene of King Lear as the perfect exemplification of the problem of flattery. Paul, you want to say a little bit?
Well, I mean, I was thinking that Cordelia's disgust with her sisters, I'm sure you all know the scene, you know, his daughters to tell him how much they love him, all their love in words. Her disgust has to do, I take it, with this emptying out, but only an inauthentic creature would be capable of this kind of flattery. That the very act of doing it shows you to be vacant, to have vacated yourself. And so her problem in refusing to flatter and nevertheless still have something to say, can she still speak, is the problem of a more authentic subject. It's the problem that doesn't go away in courtly life when it's re-emerging as the critique of courtly life from within it.
And of course, the depth of the scene, right, is it turns out that the question of flattery overlaps perfectly with the question of love. That is, how can there be an expression of love under conditions of courtly life that doesn't empty out into mere flattery? That's why Cordelia feels that her only recourse is silence. But silence, as Lear thunders, right? You say nothing, you get nothing. So one's life is lived at this structure, right? And that's what's exactly played out in the opening scene of Lear. It's corruptive power, right? And that's what's so wrenching about the scene. It's corrupting power is that it does not allow authentic speaking to occur. That once theater becomes, let's call it, the operative mechanisms of the social relation, then the notion of authenticity, that is saying, I actually love you, I love that, I just have the words of love, become impossible, right? They become so much more hollow talk. And Cordelia just won't, you know, it's as if she is hyper aware of the transformation from externality into emptiness is automatic, pushes her into silence that then becomes a sign of the very opposite of what she intends. That is, her silence as a way of trying to hold herself within her real wanting of love becomes a statement of rejection of the other, right? And hence she's the one who gets cast out. So this logic of flattery, this emptiness of court life, has another... It's interesting. Because Speight, in his book, calls this comedy. And that's how Hegel plays it, but I think we can see it's equally tragedy. It's not obvious that this is a comedy at all.
It's not a comedy if there's really love.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only a comedy if there's
nothing. Nothing there. As soon as there's really something at stake, then that structure has a tragic lining. Yeah.
The import of what's her name's line, I love you no more than duty allows. or whatever the exact quotation is.
Which is why the flip side of Lear is Cinderella, right? So that there is something comic about the ugly sisters, right? And they are played comically. So it's the tension between the comedy of those who want only hollowness and the one individual who wants authenticity or love.
And if you don't think Cordelia loves Lear and vice versa, it is a comedy.
Sure, no, I guess what I'm asking is, I can see from what Jason said why Cordelia's actions tell us something profoundly important about the nature of love. But it's not clear how, in terms of play, why flattery is shown to reveal something that then turns out to be important for the development.
Okay, good. No. It turns out that so the transition moment, let's see if this helps. You're absolutely right. The future of the transformative power, the movement of spirit, depends on the playing out of this emptiness to the very end. Why it's Rameau's nephew and not Shakespeare here. And that's because, but this is very close to Lear, because his way of analyzing it is that the continual language of flattery so empties the self out, it becomes a moment of madness, right? And that moment of madness throws the self back onto itself without any masking at all. That's how he works the transition. So paragraph 526... That's beautiful. Thank you. That's great. He runs through the whole structure of the analysis, and then top of page 321, he says, it is the self-disruptive nature of all relationships and conscious disruption of them, but only as self-consciousness in revolt is it aware of its own disrupted state, and in thus knowing it has immediately risen above it. So it's not in the moment of love, it's in the moment of what's called disgust that the transition happens. Right? There is no room for content here. Right? There is no room for content. That's why Lear is a tragedy. That's why, if I'm right about tragedy, tragedy necessarily is non-transformative. That's what it's about. It's about limited situations that cannot be further sublated. Right? Tragedy is that blockage of sublation. Which is why, we'll have to get to this, why there's a whole argument about whether this book is a comedy or a tragedy. Right? But only as self-consciousness in revolt is it aware of its own disrupted state, and thus knowing it has immediately risen above it. In that vanity, all content is turned into something negative, which can no longer be grasped as having a positive significance. So this is the emergence of the moment of negativity itself for its own sake. Right? It's that moment where if my manipulating of the masks is self-defeating, then all I am left with as is my distance from any mask, which is myself as sheer negativity. That's the thought. So the positive object is merely pure I itself, called the transcendental unity of apperception, the cogito, pure negativity. And the disrupted consciousness in itself, this pure self-identity of self-consciousness that has returned to itself. So to speak, early modernity, having discovered subjectivity. As it were, played it out, but played it out as an empty form. That's the argument. And if it's just an empty form, right, then we have a problem. So the response to that problem is to say that the self now has relocated itself as this power of negativity and now has to find content. And that content appears in two signature ways. Faith and enlightenment. That those are the return out of the emptiness of modern subjectivity in the search for an absolute content. So, the way Hegel runs the argument is to say that skepticism about culture, which now means about pure culture, which means about Bildung, about self-alienation, all of that which we've been now reading, right? So the whole episode now of culture and Bildung, right, turned out to be about the self-formation of a self-making self, right? But it turned out that there was no content to that. And we now are left with that moment of negativity and how we're going to find content again. Which is, again, the question is how secular modernity can have content if the principle of secular modernity is subjectivity, is the pure I, is I think. And Hegel says that in response to the hollowness and vanity of early modern of culture, what was the response to it was, on the one hand, a new type of religiosity as an expression for the desire for spiritual substance. So what he's thinking at is the forms of Protestantism. So Pietism, Jansenism in France, that's the form, and Jansenism is a really interesting moment. Right, because that's Pascal, Quietism, Wesleyanism. What all of these share is a new emotional relationship to essence, and hence an attempt to have a immediate relationship between subjectivity, which we're calling now faith, in this now significant, new, and weighty sense, that Luther and then Pascal are inventing. I want to be clear now, we're inventing this notion of faith because this is the immediate relation of the self via this posture to its object and corresponding to it, and this is the trick of Hegel's whole argument here, and corresponding to it a passionate naturalism that we call enlightenment, with its emphasis on unbiased thought and observation. So the trick now, or the rest of the argument here, running right through the French Revolution, for reasons that I'm now going to try to spin out, are to say that, and this is crucial for Hegel, as it is, by the way, for Adorno, who stole the idea for his entire book from this chapter, that faith and pure insight, faith and enlightenment, are a couple. They are wedded together. They cannot be separated. They need and depend on one another. And now I'll try to show you a bit why that must be the case and why that folly à deux as the logical structure that will take us, I think, almost seamlessly, once we understand their relationship, to the French Revolution. That's certainly Hegel's attempt here, to make the French Revolution the political realization and working out of the impossible relationship between faith and enlightenment. Well, faith and enlightenment share two assumptions. And we can say that the two assumptions are themselves simply the different moments of the transcendental unity of apperception. So the two moments are the following. First, that to know X, or to believe in X, or to be related to any substance is to submit it to authoritative grounds that are not dependent on any transcendent source for their authentication. Say that again. It's just what we mean by you have to think for yourself. But I'm saying it in the most complicated way I know how. That is, that for you to have a belief at all, it must match grounds that are fully acceptable to you as believing subjects. So this is the idea that there can be no given authority. This is the critique of all givenness, right? That anything for us to count for us as authoritative must be conformable to the mechanisms of subjectivity. So it must be an internal relationship that puts us in relationship to any externality. Right? So in Descartes, I mean, just to use Descartes as the simple way, it's certainty. Right? So when he does the reguli, he says that let's look at a long logical procedure. What does he say? He must be certain of, immediately aware and certain of the premise. And then you must, in seeing the relationship between the premise and the next step, treat that as itself an immediate certainty. So the whole thing tries to be an idea of the whole train must have the awareness of an immediate self-certainty of the whole path. Right? So that as if I am aware of what's external by it having the weight for me of immediate self-certainty. But that also is what we mean by faith. That my belief in God, my inner resolve that He is my Lord and Savior and I am saved, does not come from Him. Right? Faith is that I give Him that authority, right? That my self-possession works through a self-dispossession, right? So it's that double movement. The second side of that modern belief, which is again just the critique of external authority, that's all I'm suggesting. It's simply what we mean by we have no reason to believe anything for which we do not have reasons that are okay for me. Right? That we take nothing on, I would say nothing on faith, but we take nothing on another person's say-so, and therefore I have to fully believe it, where believing can now be either cognitive or affective religious. Right? Same thought. Secondly, that to know X is to be in possession of grounds for belief that hold for all individuals, that is, that are universal. So the trick of modernity is to want a moment of radical subjectivity in the authoritative grounds for belief that is simultaneously universal. Which, again, I've said before, is the trick of Descartes and Kant, namely to find in the inner structure of subjectivity, a moment of universality that holds for everyone. That's what the transcendental unity of apperception means, and that's what the moral law means. Now, as forms of spirit, as ways of people comporting themselves as a people to the world, faith and pure insight both give on to the whole of spirit, but, this is Hegel's argument, in divided form. And his rough and ready thesis here is that the moment of faith is a moment of a sheer, immediate awareness of content, of pure, unmediated awareness of substance. Or, if you want to do romantic poetry, what Jeffrey Hartman calls the unmediated vision. So this will run right through, this moment will run right through early romanticism. This is his analysis of Wordsworth, right through, in fact, that book ends with Rilke. So faith is immediate awareness of content as essence beyond intellection. That's the crux of it. It's beyond intellection, which is why it's an emotive or emotional relationship to the absolute. Conversely, pure insight is a refusal of all content and is a skeptical interrogation of content that hopes to achieve the truth through a negative and skeptical process. That is, by doubting everything until we can make it certain. Now, put in this way, we might say that pure insight is concepts without intuitions, and faith is intuitions without concepts. So the relationship between enlightenment and religion here is being set up like a Kantian structure. That religion is the bearer, and it's important that religion is the bearer of the abused, lost content of modernity, and that insight is the skeptical self-consciousness of modernity looking for authoritative conviction. So, paragraph 529, I guess. Yeah, okay. Or let me just start on the bottom page 323, and then it goes over. Spirit. I always read these passages again just so you know I'm not making all this up. Spirit, in accordance with its truth, is an undivided unity, at once absolute movement and negativity of the process of manifestation, as well as, so that's going to be the moment of pure insight, as well as its inwardly satisfied essence and its positive repose. So, negativity on the one side, repose and satisfaction on the other. But coming generally under the determinateness of alienation, these two moments fall apart into a dual consciousness. So that description for Hegel is how he's going to describe spirit at the very end. It's both always self-moving and in repose, right? That famous passage from the preface. But at this moment, those moments are still divided. So he says, but coming generally under the terminus of alienation, these two moments fall apart into a dual consciousness. The former is pure insight as the spiritual process which focuses itself in self-consciousness, a process which is confronted by consciousness of what is positive, the form of objectivity or of picture thinking, and which turns against it. But pure insights, so this is Kant, think for yourself, never believe anything until you have proof of it. This is the form that the fundamental gesture of enlightenment is critique. And above all, we're going to say the critique of religion. That enlightenment is the attempt to vindicate secularity through the critique of religion. The simple consciousness of the positive, or tranquil self-identity, on the other hand, has for its object the inner essence qua essence. And then he runs what I'm calling the Kantian synthesis, or the broken synthesis. Pure insight has therefore, in the first instance, no content of its own, because it is negative being for self. To faith, on the other hand, there belongs content, but without insight. Insight without content is empty. Insight without faith without concept is blind. So the thought here is that enlightenment has no content of its own, and therefore what it is a drive to intellection and rationality, and we might say it's a metaphysical desire for universality, and as such it challenges every content to meet its standards of rationality. That is, show me that you are absolutely and purely compatible with the demands for pure rationality, or you are nothing. And you will begin to hear what is called the logic of suspicion, which is going to be the logic of the French Revolution itself and lead to the terror. So I want you to hear already in Enlightenment skepticism, and enlightenment as skepticism, and in Jim Schmidt's wonderful reader on enlightenment, if you read all those documents of German and French enlightenment, the one thing that is steady throughout all of it is skepticism of anthropomorphism. Right? That the problem enlightenment faces is it looks as if we have populated the world with projections of ourself. Some of them we call God, some of them we call nature, but they're all just personifications or projections of the human. And we have to see through them. So what we want is self-evidence and certainty. At paragraph... What do I want to say here? I'm running out of time. So what I'm going to suggest is, and we'll pick up here next week, that what gives enlightenment its authority and its power and its content is its skeptical procedure. That is, it shows itself to be having dinner with an analytic philosopher. He says, you know, that guy has his chops. So the way in which enlightenment shows it has its chops is by showing that other people's beliefs are false or hollow or empty. Right? And what we call this is being a first-year philosophy student, right? What I'm trying to get you to see is why this is a powerful moment. Why skepticism can feel like itself a deep form of authority. What I mean by skepticism is not doubting everything, but a skeptical procedure of doubting, where you grow in your convictions of the depth of your subjectivity by the power of your methods of doubt. That is, there's something tremendously authorizing about this. I mean, it's part of what attracted all of us to philosophy, to discover that we could doubt things that our parents told us was true, right? Every philosopher is still rebelling against the law of the father. And maybe searching for mother's love. Bad way to get it. And this is going to be, this process is going to be shown that it depends on its object. That's the thought here. That if this mechanism is you get your authority through doubt, then you need something to doubt. You get your, sometimes, in the language of this thought, enlightenment is said to be a light, right? Illumination. What is light? Add an object to shine on. Sheer emptiness. So what Hegel wants to do is take the moment of negativity, right, and show how it's bound to the object that it is doubting. And that without that object, it would be empty. Which means, and this is the difficult moment that we're going to have to think about over and over again, that religion is a kind of misunderstood object. That religion is the bearer of an absent content that we haven't figured out. And I don't mean God. I mean it's the placeholder for content. And we have to figure out what that content is. Okay.